Tonight we got Gary from the North Summit Ridge Home Group. His sobriety date started in 1997. This time I'm not sure of the whole story, but I'm really looking forward to it. Y'all welcome Gary.
Thanks, everybody. My name's Gary Neidhart. I'm an alcoholic. I'm originally from Sugar Falls, Ohio, and I'm going to take a little liberty with you and do something that isn't normally done down here, but is quite often done up in Ohio. It's the way they start up meetings up there, and they start up the meeting with just a brief prayer, and it's a brief prayer for healing. Because my thoughts very much this evening are with a dear friend that is, as my sponsor says, is entering a period of transition, Bob Meadows. And also we've got a pigeon of my wife's, Ginny, whose mother is also entering that period of transition. And I would like to just take just a moment, just a brief moment together in silence to take the goodwill that we have here in this room and beam it to those people that really need it tonight. Will you join me in doing that just for a brief moment? Amen. Thank you so much. I am at the Clarkston. They have at the other side of the podium here. They have a little saying that says "Expect a miracle." And I originally, one of the meetings that I came into and spent a good deal of time was at Clarkston. And I'm one of those who had a great deal of contempt for those words. It seems, for this alcoholic anyway, you've got to hang around a while so that the head can clear, so that you can be around long enough to learn some things about yourself. And I have a particular example here. What I have here is I have a big book. The big book is my father's. This is a family disease. The cover is a cover that was given to me by my sponsor, Bill Roop. It has very nice, it has his name on the back in case I would ever forget it. And it has, January the 3rd of 1957 on the back. Well, it was actually in 1980 that my father, at the tender age of 64 years old, wanted to find a place that he could stay anonymous. So he came down to Peachford Hospital. And, of course, that was a secret. It was not only a secret, it was a secret for every member of the family, except, I guess, for my mother. It was in 2004 when my dad died in 1997. It was in 2004 that my sister and I were digging through the house looking for whatever we could find. We came across letters. These were letters that we'd never seen before. The letters were written by my dad to my mother, and the return address was Peachford Hospital. And that absolutely blew me away. Now, for some of you that were in Peachford Hospital, maybe, or had some exposure to the place, Peachford Hospital was founded by Conway Hunter. Now, Conway Hunter was sponsored by Mickey Milner. Mickey Milner was sponsored by Bill Roop. And this book is the symbol of what put them together. Now, how I could go from 30 years in Ohio and 15 years in New England and end up being the pigeon of someone who was the grand sponsor of a doctor that helped take care of my father, you figure that out. Who's been in control all along? And that, to me, is just an example of how, in many regards, to the person that may be, going out or thinking of it, part of the miracle is, you see, of us being here and being sober one day at a time, is we have no idea what that one drink might cost us. And that's why it's just such, I'm just so pleased to be here today, sober, and be able to talk to other people like me who are willing to make or give a chance of that next miracle to happen. The feel good. The type of reward. I was looking for love in all the wrong places. And I like to consider myself as I'm an alcoholic. I qualify for multiple fellowships. I was in Al-Anon in 1976. My dog goes to Allopet. I mean, you name it, I qualify for it. Recovery has many surprises in it. And a lot of those surprises have to be around here for a while to be able to have a chance to see them. Now, again, I said I'm from Chagrin Falls. That's Disappointment, as in Disappointment Falls. Otherwise, and I'm also, that's a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, which is otherwise known as the Mistake on the Lake. Now, see, if you were like me, no wonder you drink, right? Of course, in Akron, 40 miles away from Cleveland. Now, Akron is Portage County. And many of you might not know that Akron was originally founded as part of the Ohio Erie Canal. And so, upon learning, me being an archivist and a history buff, the minute that I found out that the locks in Akron having its history, immediately what I wanted to find out, I bet you there are 12 locks that go from Cleveland to Akron. Bummer, it was 17. But I'll just say that the flavor of Cleveland is it's a little bit different up there to do Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll say there's sober people up there too. You know, so, and part of the joy of being in this fellowship is there are subtle differences. But getting back to me, I'm somebody that was a late bloomer with the way people are today in this fellowship. I didn't drink until I was 18. I didn't drink until I went to college. And I immediately had a little difficulty in terms of moderation. I ended up on crutches as a result of a drunk. That was because I lost my fraternity pin, and it's something I don't really remember how I did. But in the middle of my stupor, I went outside looking for my fraternity pin in the middle of the night, fell on a beer bottle, and I can still remember getting cut on my shin, going off to the emergency room, and a guy looking at me in the eyes, and he goes, "Can you see out of those?" And my sophomore year, I ended up ending up on crutches again, and that was because I was playing a mean game of charades drunk, jumped out of a chair, and just simply twisted my ankle when I came down, then went out dancing on it. And then I couldn't walk anymore when it time to take the lady home after, let's just say, being off my feet for a little bit. I have to tell this because it is the truth. It's when those other substances showed up in 1968 that kind of like delayed me coming into this fellowship, I'm convinced, for quite a while. The summer of 1968 was my junior year, that fall term, is when the Vietnam vets showed up at my campus. And that was a brave new world from that day forward, because they came in with all of their connections. And basically, my life turned out to be, what do you got? How long does it last? And can we do some more? And that was pretty much what my last 3 years in college basically were. And occasionally from that result, I think I still occasionally glow in the dark. But as a result of, I kind of got in this mood that if, as long as you didn't do too much of any one thing, that was okay. Just spread out and do as many things as possible. So that's what I did. With one thing though, in my particular story, it's does the man make the times, or does the time make the man? And I am so much a believer that the time makes the man. on December 2nd of 1969, I won the lottery. That was the draft lottery. It's the only draft I've ever won. Okay, and so, now mind you, I was trying to be, at one, due to the fact that my father was a lieutenant colonel of the second largest ROTC unit in the country. That was prior to World War II. He wanted me to be an ROTC. I was an Air Force ROTC. And I did that for 2 years, but then with the war or whatever else, I decided I couldn't do that anymore. But then when the military decided that I was, they wanted me, I just went into a bit of a crazy sort of a period in studying existential literature. I ended up giving a sermon at my parents' church, having been up all night stoned on psilocybin. Seemed to be a good idea at the time, but that was part of my crusade to try to be a uniform conscientious objector, which of course the draft board just looked at me and laughed. And I was ended up being drafted into the U.S. Army, and that was in June 7th of 1971, and you may not remember this, but the draft expired on June 30th of 1971, and so did I. I went off and did a little bit of AWOL. Now, you know, as part of the amends process in this, we have no idea what we do to people when we're tornadoes. I have no idea at all how selfish I could be, how self-centered, and it also takes some time in this outfit to even figure that out. You know, my mother passed just last July, and we emptied that house. And we had been uncovering letters that had been kept, you know, by the family. We have letters. I haven't counted them yet. 700 to 900 of them, and I've typed most of them. I typed all of the ones that date from back to the 30s, my dad's military record during World War II, my mother's letters to her mother when in the 30s, and so on. But I also came across my mother's a letter that my mother wrote, where she, of course, thought that she's back in World War II thinking, well, she thought I was going to be shot. Okay. And I had no idea until just very recently what I, you know, for good or for ill or for right, there's no wrong or right about that, but it's just simply what we can do when we're in the blindness of whatever we think it is that we got to do at the moment. You know, and the tornado doesn't know sometimes what it does and how necessary it can be as part of our amend process. I ended up, when I didn't have any idea what I was going to do, but through a fortunate set of circumstances, I was put in contact with a child psychologist in Dallas, Texas, that used to go on vacation with my mother. And he wrote me up, and see, I'm an old violin player, and I went back to the U.S. Army with a violin. I'm a recovering violin player as well. And I went back, and I could play Oklahoma or Carousel, and I could do the soliloquy from Billy Bigelow. And the long and short of it is I pulled a clinger, if you're a MASH fan at all. And I was able then, actually, it was also that Dr. Don Morris, a lovely child psychologist from Dallas, Texas, wrote me up as being a heterohomo masturbative sexual schizoid. So that helped too, okay, in getting me out. And in all honesty, I just wanted to get out so I could get back to my habits and my mood changers, which I missed a lot. And that worked. And by September 20th of 1971, I got out on a general discharge. I was unsuitable for military service, and at the time I thought that was pretty good. But again, it was just some of the craziness of that time. And I ended up getting a job, I got a job with my father's company, and for a period of time, I just went back to my old habits, which were at that time just simply drinking and doing just one mood changer. You know, and realize this is Alcoholics Anonymous, which so I'll try to again minimize that. But there was a period of moderation there. I did the over a period of time, however, it was my my father who never showed a sign of having any sort of problems with liquor whatsoever. A very successful Fortune 500 executive. Now, mind you, they say that alcoholism is an equal opportunity destroyer. It's from, it applies from Park Avenue to the park bench. And his variety is much more of a Park Avenue, you know, a president of a large corporation. But my mother had had kidney stones. And she was in the, this is about 75, and my she was going to have a kidney operation at that time, which was a big deal when you're cutting through the back muscles, as I understand, is going to be a substantial recovery from it. And so my brother and I showed up at St. Joseph Hospital up in Cleveland after work to see how she was after her back operation, and my father met us at the lobby. And he gave us this first-class run-around about how what a wonderful woman my mother was, and how we didn't care about her, or we didn't appreciate her, we didn't treat her right. Jeez, where did this come from? And so my brother gets us, gets away and goes over to ask, you know, where my mother was recovering. And it was only then that we recognized there was no kidney operation. She passed the kidney stone. My father was too drunk to know. So that's another one of the things that we, when they're in the tornado, we just don't really know. So actually, the first time I had anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1976 when we participated in an intervention in his office. I didn't say a word. I just watched. My brother was there too, and there were probably eight of us. Of course, interventions being what they are, without any willingness, you know, that intervention took place in 1976. He got sober in 1987, and that gave him 9 years of sobriety before he died, which, for in all honesty, I was really very grateful for. It's just without that degree of willingness, what can you do? I mean, but it's also an example that for any of you that might be of the younger sort, it's never too early, it's never too late. And actually, Mary and I were at a meeting at, it was my sister and I that went to a meeting in Pawleys Island, South Carolina, and that's my record for a lady coming in. And she was 95 years old, and she was, had 14 years. She came in at 81. A little short lady and just a delightful pistol. And of course, then many of the folks have been around, known of June G, who came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles at the tender age of 13. I think she turns 50 this year, and she'll be 50 years old with 37 years of sobriety. So that's the span of you know, and so if you're in between those ages, I think this can work for you. Getting back to me, I ended up, after my father, in one of his events, I sat right across from me in a picnic table, and he looks at me in the eyes, and he goes, "Who are you, young man?" I ended up doing a geographic cure, and that was more or less, mind you, I'm not sober by any stretch of the imagination. I did go to Al-Anon for a brief period of time. There were two men, and I was one, and there may have been 22 women, and I was quite happy with the woman that I was dating at the time, thank you. And that's as much as I knew of the steps or anything else about it, as much as I paid attention to it. But I did a geographic cure, and I went to Rhode Island for 3 years. I was in the Boston area for 3 years, and I was in the New Hampshire area for 8. Now, just there's the reality, and then there's the myth. Some of you will know there's the television show Cheers. Okay, well, in 1981, I was looking for a place to go. There, you know, I'm single. I'm in Boston. I don't know anybody, so I go to Boston, the Boston Garden, Boston Commons, and there's this place called the Hampshire House, beautiful Georgian front. This place, it's a $10 cover charge to get in there for both sexes on a Friday night. I figured, well, golly, if a lady's going to pay $10, that's got to be a good place to go. So I became a member there. That's the place that turned out to be the front, what was used by Cheers is where a place where everybody would know your name. Well, I was a member there, and guess what? Nobody ever knew my name. Okay, and I own luck that I didn't get a DUI coming out of that place. But it was, again, singles club, and, you know, trying to get, again, for me, looking for love in bars, never knowing what to do, but not having anything better to do either. It was in a little after that that I ended up meeting a lady. She has a kind of like a very fiery disposition. She sort of really liked me. I was a VP in a technology company, and she was a salesperson. And she liked me. We dated for a while, a couple of years. And but with her fiery temper, I told her that actually I was going to be traveling to Honolulu, and it wasn't with her. And she took her drink, threw it across the room, just started screaming at me like a madman. And before long, outside the bar, she cold-cocked me right in front of the bar. And right after she cold-cocked me, I have a hand comes on my shoulder. That's the police. And off we went to the paddy wagon because we'd made so much noise in this bar. Now, what do you do if you're an alcoholic like me with a woman like that? You marry her. Of course you do. Okay. And incidentally, if to show you, you know, when things are much better when God works out, that God's in charge and I'm not, I can remember there was this lady that moved into my neighborhood when I was a senior in high school. I thought she was fat. I just thought she was great. She wouldn't have anything to do with me. So we ended up going to the same university. She still wouldn't have anything to do with me. I would call her up, ask her out for a date, and I was a freshman at the time. And she turned me down. So I'd get some senior to call her up and ask her out, and she'd go out with him. You know, so you know, one of my character defects is self-pity, big time, false pride. And I would go to bed at night thinking about, oh, poor Gary, you know what? I finally got it into this place where I said, where would I be the day that she got married? You know? No matter how much time I wasted on that, I never even came close to the right answer. I was best man, she married my brother. They've been married for, this will be 38 years in December, so they were probably meant for each other. And as best as I can tell, all I had is that was just, I just saved myself one divorce. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. But it so turns out with, you know, that marriage, we had mutual habits in common. By that time, you know, not only was I doing a fair amount of drinking and so on, and smoking a fair amount of stuff, and also snorting a fair amount of stuff, too. You know, to give you an idea of the Polecat Ski Club up in North Conway, New Hampshire, you know, up in March, and I imagine they still do this. I don't know, but come about this time of year, they'll make an ice bar. I mean, literally, the bar is made out of ice, and after you're skiing, you'll come, you know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and you'll have the outdoor party out at the ice bar in the IMU. They're serving drinks by the 5-gallon bucket. And then 1,500, 2,000 people show up for one of these things, and you just drink yourself silly, and then maybe have a bite to eat. And then, after that, the real parties start. Okay, and that's what we did, and mind you, that kind of lifestyle, and what else did we have in that marriage? So we have three lovely children that came out of it, but over time, in my particular case, the mood changers just don't simply do the job after a while. Real life starts to interfere. Now, again, because part of the reason why I might not have been in this fellowship for a while, because I came in with when we were doing what we were doing back in the '60s, there was really the aura of doing it together, of being part of a movement, love, peace, Dope, Hare Krishna, waterbeds, that type of stuff. And, you didn't realize when you're doing the stuff alone in your basement, it's not quite the same picture. But, there's the Peter, Paul, and Mary. I wish in vain that we could be in that room once again, $10,000 at the drop of a hat. I wish I'd give it all gladly if life could be like that. Well, life was no longer like that. Keith Lewis, a fellow who's gone to his great reward and would deal with the alcoholic idea of how one... He got drunk for the first time in Pittsburgh when he went back to the big city, and he would say the rest of his drinking trying to get back to Pittsburgh. And another, there's Clancy who talks about how the alcoholic mind, how we originally start off drinking so we can feel, and in my particular case, how we can feel like men looked. And for a period of time, many of us have a great time. I wouldn't deny that. I was crazy. I had lots of fun. But over some period of time, some celestial prankster gets you playing Russian roulette, but as long as you don't have any bullets in the gun, big deal. But over time, some celestial prankster starts putting bullets in the gun. So you get click, click, boom. But then sooner or later, you go boom, boom, boom. And you're trying to say, there's got to be a good time in here somewhere. And that's what we do to ourselves. We just end up punishing ourselves when this doesn't work. And in my particular case, I honestly, in 1997, I was alone in my basement. The company had gone, that I was part of, that I was moved down to Atlanta with, had gone bankrupt. The dreams that I had and the technological work that I had gone right into the dumper. And I was in my basement, and there wasn't a single soul in Atlanta that I knew. Not one that I could count on for anything. And my the mood changers hadn't worked, and I'm rapidly approaching a divorce. I'm going to be kicked out of the house that I'm in. I've got absolutely no place to go except Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come here because I wanted merit badges or because I wanted to join the Rotary. I, like anybody else, came in here a wreck. And when I came into here to NAVA, I would count floor tiles, ceiling tiles. This room, I'm out of practice. This room is, I think it's 30 by 24. I think there's 720 of them. Okay, there are 33 rows of bricks over there, in case you ever wondered. I count things when I get really bored. Okay, and not every moment in Alcoholics Anonymous has been, absolutely enthralling. But again, when I'm into moments of just obsessed with self, You know, and one of the things, I started doing this at the Atlanta Men's Workshop, because when I came in, I was tap dancing around the guy business. There's God all over the place. But I'll tell you what got me in this program, what communicated to me. And I love the way the book, the big book, is put together, because I am also a recovering butthead. And that is with one T. But this, you don't know the way I feel. But you know where I've been. But you don't know what so-and-so my ex-wife was. Okay, because I'm so sure. I'm so sure of things. Really, it can be turned on me, my own sickness. But here is what finally penetrated to me. And I love the way the big book is put together, because it knows we're buttheads. So we have to hear the same thing over and over again. But here we go. Mean, egotistical, selfish, dishonest, angry, indignant, self-pitying, self-seeker, self-centered, egocentric. Self-pity, selfishness, self-centeredness, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, based on self, ourselves, self-will, we're unriot, rid of this selfishness, getting rid of self, self-centeredness. Did anybody get the problem out of that? Okay. And then what does it do? Where do we get the third step for getting rid of the bondage of self? What is the bondage of self? That's why I call myself a butthead. Because I am so busy when I come in here looking at me. That's all I can do. I can't see you. Because my experiences are so fresh and so real and so everything. And I'm going to have to leave here and go to some closet. Well, I called the place the closet that I lived in when I was kicked out. It was a one-room efficiency apartment. I didn't want to be there. And lots of times, though, but I'd be here, but I'd be there. Because I didn't want to be there, I wasn't all here. Okay, and I'd be angry at whatever she was going to do next, or I'd be scared that the kids were going to go up. So, actually, only a small percentage of me, mentally, was here. And what part of me was here was almost entirely incapable of listening to you. Okay, because again, all I'm doing is listening to me. And that is the bondage of self, as best as I understand. And that's what we do to ourselves. That knowledge, Mr. Bill says, this is a dumbed down society. And, you know, how do you say to people that you don't know what you think you know? Or how do you say you have to unlearn what you think you're so sure of? I'm this, I'm not that. You know, and lots of times what we end up doing to ourselves is we draw this little box and we say, I'm this, and everything I am is here, and everything else out there is different. Who does that to ourselves? I do. There's the picture of Chuck Chamberlain. And if you haven't seen that picture, you know, lots of people think of page 53, God is everything, is God is nothing. Right? But Chuck Chamberlain drew a picture of that. He's got the universe, the totality of everything. And then he's got a line, and then he's got me. Well, he actually has Chuck. And somehow our perception is there's everything, but somehow I can be outside of that. I'm different. I've heard it described that the one thing we have in common in this fellowship is that we think we're different. And that difference means that this program won't work for us. And if you think that way, welcome aboard. Because that's where we are. Okay? With that bondage of self, I wanted this program to be the instant feel-good. I would sit in a chair over there, and I would hear laughter. I would hear people smiling. And, you know, and I'd sit there and go, you wouldn't be smiling if you knew how miserable I was. Actually, you did know how miserable I was. You know that. It's just my own selfishness. But having to come back here a while, this place is not an instant fix joint, because all I knew was that I could sit in a chair before I got into this fellowship and have the illusion through ingesting a liquid or a solid, I'd feel better. Well, you take away that, and you're left with somebody sitting in a chair doing what? Nothing. Recovery doesn't work like that. You're not going to be able to sit on your butt in this outfit and feel good. The action, that's, you know, why do we have a chapter? It says into action. What we have to do is we have to go out and we have to find the action. My wife and I had a good example of that. We were just very recently down in Savannah. And of course, her home group is right here at the early morning study group, 7:30. So she's used to doing meetings early in the morning. I never thought the day would come that I was going to be doing that, but with her. But we ended up going to a meeting at Savannah. I think it was called the Sunrise Meeting. And it's at 7 o'clock. And so we were staying on Tybee Island, and we get up, and we're there at 6:45. A little lady that's chair of the meeting takes one look at her, and she says, "You're chairing the meeting. I read how it works." And we had a nice meeting. It's over by 8 o'clock. We go over to a square in Savannah to have our breakfast, which my wife brought. And a guy comes running up to us. He said, "Oh, I'm so happy I found you. I thought I'd lost you. Here's two tickets. Go for free. Take the buses and go around Savannah." And he was at the meeting. And then as we wandered around at various places, we ran into three other people that happened to be at that meeting. And so I will ask you, where else, in what other outfit, can you meet four people twice in a city you don't know before 10:30 in the morning? That's what we got. That's what comes with this outfit. But the point of the matter there was, that didn't come to us. We had to go to it. And those solutions are there for us if we're willing to take action. Now, what's available to us also, and this is just going to be my experience, and I hope you have similar ones to it, is that I need healthy messages coming to me from as many different directions as possible in as many different ways as possible. So discussion meetings are great. I mean, I need them. I thrive on them. But speaker meetings are a very necessary ingredient. But then there's conventions, there's retreats, there's a whole variety of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing is, of course, there's always the one-on-one of a sponsor and a sponsee. But then there's also other activities, and one of the activities that that in the philosophy of for free and for fun is jail meetings. And Mr. Bill and I started doing jail meetings. He started a couple of years before I did, but I'm in my seventh year doing it. Now, so it turns out, this was about 5 or 6 years ago, is that I'm at I'm out waiting out in the waiting room at the Gwinnett County Jail, and I meet a father that I know from one of the meetings that happens to be in Gwinnett County. And I asked him what he's doing there, and he says that his son has been arrested. His son's in jail. And we go in, and I meet the son. And the son is maybe comes to the jail meeting for maybe five times until he goes off to a boot camp. Maybe a year and a half later. I go to a meeting of a solution group, and I meet the same father and the same son at that meeting, and both of them come up to me and give me an attaboy for doing the jail meeting. Now, I'll tell you, I know what a rush is for my druggy days, and see, and I know it is a feeling that I can get from the tip of my toes to the top of my head. Okay, and that's the sensation I got then. My sponsor says, you reap what you sow. And in this outfit, one of the big differences is that if you're doing the next right thing, I choose to believe that you will get back. But unlike a drink and a drug, see, in this outfit, you don't know when. That's what you've got to turn over. We have faith that we will get back, but we're not in the results business. We're in the effort business. And that is where it's so necessary. But I'll tell you, when we get back, it's fabulous. It's for free, and the quote unquote high that I get from participating in that type of event, it lasts a whole lot longer than the stuff I used to buy. And it's real. See, and tomorrow, as it just turns out, my discussion leader is a fellow that came to just one of those jail meetings. And this is, I'm not going to bring this up because this is not about me. Please don't get the wrong idea. This is not about me at all. He goes to one jail meeting, he comes here, he sees me 2 weeks ago Friday, walks up to me and goes, "Gary, I want to thank you for saving my life." Okay. Again, that's not to blow my own horn. Because that could have been any of us that is there in a position to give for free and for fun without expecting anything in return. And that's, as it so turns out, one of the unexpected byproducts of being in this fellowship is here we come in, and again, thinking that I'm a know-it-all, and I'm going to deal with my drinking problem. Well, what it really deals with here is this is a living problem. But now the book, As Bill Sees It, which we use quite a bit. Remember that if you come and look at the book as it was originally published, it's the AA Way of Life, a reader by Bill Wilson. What this really is we come here broken, busted, and we come out of here necessity, if you're like me, without any other place to go, and we find a new way to live. And we turn out to be surrounded by people that, if we see them clearly, turn out to be the people that we were looking for all along in all of those strange places, doing all of those strange things that we used to do. You know, these are the people, and that's why, you know, I find that what we are willing to do, the stories of giving that are in this outfit, are truly humbling. What we are really willing to do for each other, the way we love each other, the way we root for each other, the way we do things for each other, we realize that it is truly through giving. It's the givers that turn out to be the people with the smiles on their face. No amount of taking ever provides the joy, the simple feeling of wealth, of feeling good about oneself all the way through. There's no amount of consumption that can give that to you, because whenever it is, whatever you're consuming is gone, so is it. This is, through giving, something that truly lasts, becomes a permanent part of you, and is just a wonderful way to live. And I feel so blessed that we have together the opportunity to come here as takers and become givers and become part of really a wonderful solution, of which I really had no idea that it was here for me, and I am so convinced it's here for any of us that want to be part of it. With that, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Gary. Speaking for myself, when I first came here, when I was somewhere between powerless and finding a greater power, you came to a meeting with Mr. Bill, and you guys shared, and I was doing my Mr. Invisible disappearing act after the meeting, and you came right up to me and looked me right in the eye and just told me that there was hope And it really meant so much to me, and I really do appreciate it. Thank you. Seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declaring outside contributions, donations support the group, and AA its own. Now I've asked David to give out the chips.
I'm David, I'm out of Dallas. And David, here at the Monday night leadership speaker meeting, we have a chip system in Marco County Society. We have a white chip for anyone who wants to join our way of life. We have a silver chip, 30 days. And a red chip for 90 days. One chip for 6 months. A green chip for 9 months. And blue chip for years for most of us.
Hi everybody, I'm Lori, I'm an alcoholic. This is fine. Oh my God. And then this lady the other day, I was down at the gazebo, and I'm not going to hang out there anymore, this lady said, God, when you first came in, you were that shit crazy. And I'm thinking, God, I really, really was. But you know, I stayed close to the program. It's helped me through school. I've got an awesome sponsor that I waited to get the right sponsor before I did my fourth step. And I listened to her most of the time. I'm still working on this treasure map idea. But other than that, you know, I completely listen to everything she has to say, and I actually do it now. And that has helped me a lot. So I owe everything that I have in my life. I just got accepted at grad school at Georgia State. So I owe everything that I have in my life to this program and the support that I get. So thank you.
Anybody more? Here's Muggles. And we're off the white chip one more time. And for sure, I'll leave it up here.
Do we have any AA-related announcements? Yes. Yes, Bert.
My name's Big Bert. I'm an alcoholic. Like so many other Alcoholics Anonymous meetings at NAVA's. Gracious to facilitate. There's a newcomer meeting that happens in this room every Tuesday night, and we concentrate and focus our topic of discussion of the first, second, and third step and the topic of sponsorship. So if you're new and you haven't worked those steps and you're looking for a sponsor, why don't you come out at 8 o'clock on Tuesday night? It happens every Tuesday. And if you've been around a while and you don't have enough sponsors, you're not working with anybody. There are some newcomers coming to that meeting that are willing to learn this way of life. And we don't have enough people that have been around a while to help us carry the message of hope on an individual basis for the people that come to that room. And we would appreciate it if you come out and help us carry the message of hope and recovery for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks a lot for that.
Thanks, Paul. Yes, yes.
That's the Sober Grateful Alcoholics. Saturday night at 8 p.m. in this room. We're on the 11th step, the second part of it, and the person to take us through it is a old-timer, and Paul McGee, he will take us through that, and the prayer that you sent up, Bob Meadows was a part of the one who started this 12 and 12 meeting, so you're all invited. It's at 8 p.m., and after that, we go out and we eat dinner, and we continue the fellowship. All are welcome.
Thank you, Justin. Mark?
My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Lord.
I have a teaching list suggested if anyone would like in the 80s, please see that to me.
And my name is John, an alcoholic. Bill will be telling his story on the 22nd of this month at 3828 Stewart Road.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Anyway. At 8 o'clock?
At 8 o'clock.
May 21st and 24th, the Atlanta Marriott Marquis and 51st ICCOP, which is the International Conference for Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous, will be here in Atlanta. I got fired from the car. If you would like to rest your floor, if you'd like to help somebody else get to the conference, they do accept scholarships too, so that's a great way to have some service. See me after the meeting.
Okay, since you say break it down. And next Monday night, we have Jim. Jim was a discussion leader at the 545 today. Just fantastic meeting today. He's going to tell his story. He's been in the program since 1984, so more experience than he has there. And I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Keeps us sober.
Good touch. I'll be around. I'm not up.